Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are difficult to predict, sometimes even difficult to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I'm super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Very good. Very good.
All right. I'm a little fried. I was traveling the first couple of days this week, and it's hard recovering from something like that. I had to fly to Chicago on Sunday, which I'll be telling a story about in a few minutes. And we had this, Monday morning, and we had this snowstorm, killer snowstorm. Sunday's first big snowstorm of the year down here at city level. The mountains have been getting lots of snow for all you skiers listening. Do come on out. They're ready for you. But first time we got any measurable snow, and it was a nasty one. Got about 15 inches, or about 10 inches anyway, out this way. And so I had to get up very early and drive through this muck to the airport and to get there on time and all that kind of stuff. And then yesterday, when I'm leaving Chicago, the storm has caught up, and I have to get back to the airport, and it's like I'm going through this whole mess again, right? Just to get there. But one of my friends I met, he was actually on his way back to Boston, and I guess they really got hit. He was at the airport for a couple, 3 hours just waiting to get on the plane, and that city is just like shut down. So I'm glad that it wasn't a trip from here to Chicago to Boston. That would have really not worked out well. But anyway,
storm even hit me down in Louisiana, believe it or not.
Is that right? Did you guys get snow?
Ice and snow. And, what's funny, the amount of ice and snow that it takes to shut down Denver or Chicago or someplace like that, divide that by a factor of maybe 50, and that's how much ice and snow it takes to shut down Shreveport. Okay.
We
just don't know how to drive on it. I say we. I've actually had enough experience on ice that I'm not the world's worst, but I'm probably not near as good as you, Phil, because you're driving on it all the time. But people from my neck of the woods they freak out and they can't drive on it, and there's just accidents galore. So pretty much, when we have any ice or any snow at all, it's like, okay, all the schools are closed. All the public buildings are closed. Unless you just have to be out, we encourage you to stay home. And so we had a couple of days like that here in Shreveport.
I grew up primarily in Western Kentucky, and it was very much the same way there. It wouldn't take an awful lot of snow to shut things down. But I lived in the city, Mayfield, Kentucky, we fancied ourselves pretty sophisticated compared to people who lived in the surrounding county, Graves County. And so we had our own school system, and they had their own school system. And, it would take very little for us to actually miss school. But the joke was that it took, like, nothing. And I remember once when I was in high school driving along with a friend, and he had finished his drink, and he wanted to do something else with a cup. I can't remember what. And he throws his ice out the window, and we're out on a country road, and he goes, "Oh, that's it. No school in Graves County tomorrow." I thought that was...
Exactly. That's not,
a bit of an exaggeration.
You do that in Shreveport, and somebody's going to have a crash. Besides, it's too hot down here to throw away ice. Ice is valuable. So
well, there you go. But the beautiful thing about snow day is it's one possible exemplification of our topic tonight, which is the good news that follows the bad news, or that comes in tandem with the bad news. Because of course the bad news being a storm and it's dangerous and it's cold and all that stuff, but the good news for kids is the snow day, right? I mean, that's just like,
exactly.
You know, there's hardly anything in the world more wonderful than that. The whole, like,
yeah,
that feeling that they closed the schools.
Yeah, an unexpected holiday, because, you know, think about it. You know, during the middle of the school year, you know, it's not like you're an adult and you can just decide I'm not going to school. You know, either you're going to school or you're at home throwing up or something, because, you know. And so it's pretty much when a snow day is like perfect, because it's even better than a holiday because it's unexpected. It's just out of the blue, and there you are at home, and hopefully there's enough snow on the ground to make a snowman. Yeah. So
exactly.
Yeah.
So we've got a lot of different takes on this that we want to get into, but I actually want to start by at least saying a word about the horrible situation in Tucson over the weekend. And I know that the president was addressing the nation about this earlier. I didn't get a chance to hear his talk on this, but I'm sure everyone knows, you don't come to this show for this kind of news, that there was a shooting in Tucson. 19 people were shot. I believe 9 have died. Is that right? I don't even...
Well, I thought it was only 6.
6 have died. Okay, well, that's better. Good.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm getting the number 9 from the 9-year-old girl who had died. That's where I'm picking that up from. One of the victims, just a child, and obviously all of them just people out living their lives, participating in a civic activity. One of them, a congresswoman, and just a bleak and horrible situation. And I don't want to profess Panglossian, if people are familiar with Candide, kind of optimism where we say, oh yeah, well, bad thing happened, but let me tell you why it's really good. That's not what we're about, and I certainly wouldn't have that kind of spin to put on this, because this is a tragedy from the word go, and any benefit that arrives, I would hold off on having that benefit if the bad thing would just have not happened. Clearly, that's the way I look at something like that. So I never want to be one of these people who says, "Oh, it's a good thing that bad thing happened." I don't think that's a good thing that it happened. But I would recommend, and I'll put a link up on the site for those who would like. I think a more eloquent take on it than I'm able to provide in terms of finding, if not the upside, if not the, the positive spin, at least the reason why we should never give in to despair. It came from, of all people, John Stewart. And I don't know, Stephen, if you've seen this clip.
I have not.
I actually found it on Facebook. PJ Manny had linked to it, and I was a little afraid to click it, because I'm like, man, I can't stand to hear anything cynical about this. It's just so far from that. And so far from, you know, there's this whole ugly thing about finger pointing and all that kind of stuff, and this is so far from that too. I was really impressed. So I had hoped actually to capture some audio from that and play it tonight, but I wasn't able to do that. So I will provide a link, and I'll just say that not for once, I'm sure he's done it many times in life. Anyway, John Stewart is able to just completely capture what I wish I had been able to say about it.
Well, you know, one of the topics we are covering tonight are diseases that we would like, you know, to see cures for, at least be made manageable in the short term. We're talking maybe in the next 5 or 10 years. Is that right, Phil? Is that what the article that you participated in was about?
That's right. I think the timeline on that is 20 years.
Okay, 20 years.
10 diseases will cure in the next 20 years. That's right.
One disease y'all did not mention, that in light of what happened on Saturday, I sure would hope that we see some serious improvement or advances in the treatment of is schizophrenia. You know, I'm you know, obviously not a psychiatrist. I don't know that this man was under the care of anybody for mental illness, but it appears quite obvious from what I have learned about him that he was mentally ill, and And there have been some experts that I've heard on the air talking about it, saying that he showed some of the classic symptoms of schizophrenia. And it's a waste of, you know, violent episodes like this are just so many good people are affected by it. And I feel sorry for this man's family too. It's like you say, it's just bad from the word go. And if we could get better at spotting people like this and getting treatment for them, that's just a good thing. Thinking that necessarily this particular episode would be the catalyst for doing that, I think that, you know, people are working on this for a while. But it'll be a great day when schizophrenia and other mental illnesses we get better at spotting the problem early and treating it, so that a lot of these episodes can be headed off. So
I completely agree, and I think in the interim, even before a cure or even before improved treatments, which I think are both coming, I don't doubt that we will see much better treatments coming and ultimately a cure for that. But ahead of all that, just better practices for detection and intervention when it's appropriate. I mean, this is just, this is the kind of thing you look at and you go, there's got to be a way that we can at least slow this down from happening. So
yeah,
we will revisit the subject of diseases at the end of the show. We've got several others, and I think you might have some more additions to the list, and we'll see if we can come up with some others. And those who have followed the link from the Speculist, you can be thinking about your own favorite diseases that I and the other interviewee missed over there on I Look Forward To. And so we'll talk about curing diseases towards the end of the show. But I want to come back to our major topic, which is, give me the bad news first. And before I thought of talking about the weather and the terrible situation in Tucson, my original give me the bad news first story that I wanted to share actually has to do with some misfortune that my family had this weekend. My father on Sunday actually took quite a nasty fall. He took a really bad fall and banged his head either on the stovetop or the counter, we're not sure which, and had to go to the emergency room. And his face was badly messed up, and they weren't sure if he had broken a rib or not. And there was some talk about whether he had had a stroke. So we went through a very nervous and worried time. He was obviously, he didn't seem to be in a lot of pain. He seemed to be in fairly good spirits, but he was not quite himself. He was kind of hard to understand, and so there was this whole, has something happened here? What's happened? And all this is occurring while I'm planning on leaving the next day. So I'm like, well, this whole trip is very likely off because, depending on what the prognosis is with my father. Well, I have other family in town. My brother's here and sister, and they were kind of really holding down the hospital because the snowstorm was going on, and they're in a suburb much closer to where my parents live than I am. So I'm kind of tracking it all by phone and by text and talking to other family members. And this whole thing unwinds where eventually later that night we learn that he's got a concussion, and that accounts for the, people get kind of loopy when they have a concussion. And yes, he did break a rib, and he broke his orbital bone, which is the around the eye socket, right? So
yeah.
I had been texting my one of my friends saying, I don't know, I just don't know if I'm going to make it or not. And the next morning I get up with, it turns out I talked to my family and they're like, yeah, no, you should, you've already planned this trip. You should really go. I'm actually looking for this message because I want to read what I wrote to him. I texted him the next morning and I wrote, let's see, let me find it. I had it here. Hey, Chris, good news is no stroke. Concussion, broken rib, trauma to the face. my brother and sister have things in hand, we'll be coming. And then we had exchanged some other messages. And I met up with him later in the day, and he goes, I want to read you this message you wrote. Good news, concussion, broken rib, trauma to the face.
Oh, no.
And I said,
stroke didn't come through?
No, it did. It did. But he's right. You know, I mean, when you look at that, you go, no, it's all in context, right? I understand what you're saying. That does read kind of strange. Hey, good news, my father has a concussion and broke his rib and has trauma to the face is an odd sentiment. But it was absolutely correct, because the good news was that he hadn't had a stroke, and everything that had occurred is, highly treatable, not permanent damage kind of stuff. I mean, it's bad, you know, when you're 78 years old and you break a rib. It's no fun, but there really was good news. And I explained to him, I said, no, look, this is all relative. And I think I did this in the right order. I didn't. I gave the good news first. And he goes, that's right. You should always give the bad news first. And so I said, you're right. Now, see, Sally's saying in the chat room, I got good news for you and bad news. But no, it should be the other way. I should have said, well, my dad has a concussion and a broken rib and trauma to his face, but no stroke. Had I done it that way, I think that would have followed the correct template. So anyway, we're very glad, obviously very grateful that Dad's going to be okay, and I've learned a valuable lesson about how to present this kind of material, which leads us to our topics for the evening. And actually, I think we've got one really good one, which has to do with what's happening with our economy and what might likely happen with our economy. And since you had posted the TED Talk on this, why don't you kind of set this up?
Okay, well, there was this TED Talk's actually almost, I think it's right at 2 years old. This TED Talk, I think, is roughly concurrent with the swearing in of our current president. I think is about the time Mr. Obama's being sworn in that this TED Talk was given. And, you know, this was at the beginning of the recession, and so he. He says, you know, bad news is we've got all these problems, and he painted a pretty bleak picture, didn't he, Phil? I mean, we really have a spending problem that's almost structural, and basically, you know, the old adage that if something can't go on forever, it won't. You know, that's
right.
That's the and so if we are spending more money than we are producing. If we are consuming more than we produce, then that just can't, you know, that can't continue forever. It can continue for a while, and it may and a lot of people may, you know, it might feel like it's going to last forever because it's going on so long. But at some point, you know, there's a time that the piper has to be paid. And so, you know, that was the first half of the speech, and you go, wow, this is pretty gloomy. Well,
yeah.
The second half of the speech. He says, and here comes a tech wave. He says, we are going to, you know, things are going to change. He talked about how we can, you know, design our own life. You know, I mean, you can build bacteria from the ground up to do what you want it to do. He mentioned a couple of experiments that are actually. They actually sound quaint, and this was only 2 years ago. You know, he's talking about putting resveratrol in beer. You know, these are you know, we're doing more interesting things now. You know, we can actually build. He didn't mention it in the speech because it was before this became available. But you know, they're basically taking chemicals now and building life from the very. You know, from nothing basically, and it's amazing the things that they're doing now. So there's that. There's robotics, and I think he includes in robotics basically the idea of artificial intelligence. And you know, and a couple of things he did not mention, you know, I think that are important are 3D printing, and how that will change the world as well. So there's, you know, you put all these things together. It seems to me that although we've had this huge structural problem of spending more than we create, our the tools that will allow us to create that are coming, I don't know. I wouldn't necessarily, you know, I don't want to be the kind of guy that just says, you know, this will necessarily rescue us. But man, it seems like there's the possibility that things might not be as bleak as you would expect otherwise. Because here comes the ability for us to be a lot more productive with these incredible tools that are coming down, coming towards us quickly. So,
absolutely, very very good talk. The guy's name is Juan Enriquez, and I believe what was the talk called? It was called "Tech Evolution Will Eclipse the Financial Crisis." I looked up his profile on TED. I don't know if you've checked that out. For one thing, I want to say he's a great speaker. He lays out this really shocking ideas and really humorous ideas in just kind of a Stephen Wright fashion.
For those who are familiar.
But here he's this founding director of the Harvard Business School Life Sciences Project, and he's also the former CEO of Mexico City's Urban Development Corporation and a chief of staff for Mexico's Secretary of State. So you look at the background and you say, okay, well, here's a guy who's well ensconced in academia. He's obviously got some good private sector experience. And when he talks about these kind of systemic problems of government spending, he's talking about it as an insider, and an insider from a country not known for its fiscal controls, right? I mean, from having witnessed it in Mexico, I think his words of caution probably take on an even greater sense of urgency. But I think the thing that really got my attention in the first half of the talk is how much of the money that our government currently spends, how much of the budget is mandatory. It's spending that it's not discretionary. You don't have any choice. You have to spend this money. It's systemic. It's built in that expenditure occurs, and that starts to look really scary, because you say, well, not that you can't eliminate mandatory spending, but man, that's a lot harder than it is with, theoretically discretionary.
It just seems to me, Phil, politically, it's it's just about impossible to say, I'm sorry, you can't have this money anymore,
right?
To a group of people that has come to expect it,
right?
That's not saying anything bad about those people. You know, people are people. If you come to depend on something, then, when somebody comes along and says, no, you can't have that anymore, man, they're the worst of bad guys. Nothing good is going to be said about that person by the person who's having something taken away from them. And so, what do you do about that? I think at some point, if we can't produce our way out of the hole, then, politically, probably the only way to handle it is to say, okay, everybody takes a cut. The entire budget, across the board, we're doing a certain percentage cut, and that includes defense and the left euphemistically calls it corporate welfare and everything else. It all gets cut, and everybody gets to suffer equally. Basically it's almost a wartime footing kind of thing. Everybody gets to contribute because this problem is nationwide. Either we do something like that, or as he said in the talk, we lose the dollar. And I don't want to imagine what the world would be like if America goes down the way Germany did prior to World War II. I can't imagine how bad that would be, not just for the United States, but the entire world.
It's a bleak scenario. I've actually got the pie chart open in front of me from the TED talk, and here's the breakdown. Okay, so 21% of our money goes to Medicare and Medicaid. 21% to Social Security, 21% to the military. For one thing, I think it's interesting that each of the big three wedges are all the same amount. All
21%.
Yeah. And then 10% other mandatory. You know, it's like all the other mandatory spending. 9% interest, truly mandatory. There's nothing you can do about that. And then 18% is the rest of the budget, the discretionary budget. So even if you could cut discretionary budget to a third of its current size, you'd only be cutting 12% out of the budget. It's almost like if you really need to make something happen. And, of course, then you'd be in the situation where even more of your spending would be mandatory. I think your point that perhaps we could produce our way out of it. It seems if we suddenly had a much, much bigger pie, that the proportions might change. If you have more money, then you're going to spend more money on the military, but you might not have to spend 21% of a larger share. You might find that that's only 18% of that share, and maybe only 17% on Social Security or whatever. But the fact that those are mandatory means you know that there's very little option around it, and the projections are that that one little wedge sticking out there, the 18% that is not those things, gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and truly you face this kind of bleak potential set of circumstances. Now, I'm not of the opinion that we'll lose the dollar, and I'm not of the opinion that that we're going to go under. I'm actually kind of surprised to see, as he relates it in the video, how fast we have increased the amount of spending that's mandatory. And it almost feels like one of those progressions like the things Kurzweil talks about, where technology...
Almost exponentially.
We're
going into debt exponentially here.
Exactly. I mean, it's just, maybe not so much the exponential aspect, but one of the things Kurzweil talks about with the law of accelerating returns is just that the relentlessness of it, that it carries on in wartime and in peacetime and in famine and when X is happening and when Y is happening, it just doesn't seem to matter, right? It just seems to keep happening. And when you follow the train, it looks like it just really doesn't matter who's in charge or what. We keep declaring more and more money as mandatory. So I think ultimately we have to recognize that that's an issue, and we have to get spending under control. I think everyone finally has to, will agree to that at some point. How that happens, I don't know. And we'll leave it for we'll leave it for a big political roundtable, I suppose, at some point to talk about specifically how it happens, other than increasing productivity, which is a thing we talk about all the time, and creating a bigger pie. To me, that always feels like the solution. Certainly, when President Reagan was in office, and we had, a lot of the same fear expressed at those times. In fact, I always feel like it's deja vu when I hear a lot of this stuff about the economy, because a lot of the things I'm hearing about the economy today, I heard about the economy back in those days. Just in terms of how big the deficit is, and we're writing all these bad checks, and we're going to throw them at our dump them on our grandchildren, and then 6, 7, 10 years later, we had a budget surplus. The economy was booming, well beyond anyone's projection of how good things were going to get, and nobody talked that way.
And that was a productivity boom.
Yeah,
I think that was a dividend from increased productivity, and I think that we could see that again. I think that really, really could happen. And imagine how awesome it would be, Phil, if the whole healthcare problem went away because we just got so much better at treating things. If it wasn't costing such a large percentage of our budget just to take care of our own health. If we didn't have that to worry about, that'd be huge as well.
Well, in fact, Sally is saying, think about how healthcare costs will plummet when our tech can cure diseases that are merely managed very expensively nowadays. Exactly,
exactly.
Right, Sally. Yeah, I mean, that's that's where this thing has got to go. And
it's
interesting.
Something interesting that I have to. That we have a new commenter in the chat room. Welcome, Black Hat. He says that rejuvenation tech will certainly help with Social Security costs. Well, Social Security disability, maybe. I see that point, but. When it comes to Social Security retirement, we got to rethink Social Security retirement if we got people living to 110, 120, 130. We got to rethink that whole scheme. If people are productive longer, then maybe we don't need to be paying them to retire. So,
well, at least not at age 65. And I believe that one of Enrique's points, I think it's in this talk. He talks about one of the things you just pretty much have to accept is that we're going to move that age up for Social Security, and I think there are probably other things that are going to have to happen along those lines. But
maybe it should be tied to a particular person's health. Some people are a lot older at age 65 than other people. If that makes sense.
No,
it's I've seen people that are worn down at age 50. To a greater extent than a lot of people that are age 70. It's just, I don't know, maybe it needs to be tied to health and maybe to other retirement sources or something. I don't know, but the particular system we have in place now seems to be a little bit of a relic of times past, and a lot of it has to be rethought. So,
Sally asks, how long will Social Security last with drastically expanding youth spans? Not much longer. After that trend gets big, well, I think that's true. Although, again, a major productivity boom could breathe new life into how long Social Security goes on. It's one of those interesting things. We could end up paying a lot of money to a lot of people over a lot of years and have it not be that impactful just because we're producing so much more. I mean, that's one. That's the very happy sunny end of the. Of the quadrant is just the or a quadrant of the set of possibilities, which is the one where we get so productive and we get so good that the fact that we're really not very good at managing our money doesn't hurt us as bad as it could. I guess that's like
when you're a sexy immortal billionaire, you can retire early.
That's right. You're a sexy immortal billionaire. Well, that's the thing where the economy has shifted to the point where people are being paid out those Social Security checks, but they don't matter that much because the economy is just so much bigger than that. Social Security has grown at rate of X, and the economy has grown at the rate of X squared, for example. And everybody gets their Social Security check, which seems like a fortune because it's like $50,000 a month. But by then, everyone is worth a couple $1 trillion. Whatever the odd math might be that would get you there. That's the mega happy ending. For Wayne's World fans, right? That's the but there's also the Scooby-Doo ending where they pull the mask off the guy and he as if it weren't for you meddling kids. I would like it if Enrique said, "See, so now these technologies are going to give us the mega happy ending." But he doesn't quite say that, does he?
No, he doesn't. And I think, in part because he doesn't know, and none of us know really. But I mean. The future is a complex thing, always moving it is,
That's right.
We have this at the Speculist and here on Fast Forward Radio, we see all these good things that are in the process of coming about. And while we get there, and life goes on and including business cycles and everything else, it's an interesting and wild ride. At least it has been the last few years. It seems like
it certainly has. Well, Sally says that sexy immortal billionaires with superpowers is the FFR mega happy ending. You know what's great about that is it's really not the end. Sexy immortal billionaires with superpowers is really just kind of a transitional state before we get to the really happy ending. That's that's the amazing thing about that scenario, but. But it's hard to be sure when the next big productivity boom is going to happen, or it's hard to be certain. And I think maybe that's why he doesn't draw those lines exactly how these changes which look like they can profoundly, these technological advances look like they can profoundly change things for the better. Hard to be certain exactly when they'll kick in and what benefits they'll bring and what benefits they'll bring when. And so just as we've had in our discussion about the economy generally, where we've talked about this transition from an economy of scarcity to an economy of abundance, I think that between the bad news and the good news, you know, there's this very scary transitional period, and I'm hoping that we will approach this with the intelligence that it's going to take to get us to that next level, to really enjoy that productive economy based on these kinds of technologies. Because like the worst thing that could happen to my mind is that if we were as a country or as a civilization to say, well, you know, there's a lot of great technology out there, but we just can't afford that right now because we've got all these financial problems, right? That would be a bad move, because it's investing money and effort and time and resources into bringing these new technologies into play, which I think is really going to ultimately get us to that productivity and get us to the good news.
You know, the last ice age obviously was bad news for the animals and creatures that lived through it. But those that made it through, it seems like were much better off at the end of the ice age. And certainly that you could say that for humanity. You know, during that period of time, we adopted clothing and fire and we basically came out of that ice age as modern people. And agriculture followed soon after that. So it's, bad news.
I think what you're saying, Stephen, is that this economic crisis is going to be a good character-building experience for us. Is that maybe so.
I don't know. Yeah. Or maybe some of the solutions that we have to the problems that the problems of not having a whole lot of money, maybe. Is that we find new and interesting ways of being productive. And so whether that's a 3D printer on your desktop or whatever, we'll find new ways of being productive. And maybe we can produce our way at least to reduce the problem.
I think so. I think that's the direction we're looking for. Well, I see we're running close on time, and I've got a couple more of these I want to talk about. The next one actually comes from Fast Forward Radio itself, so I've got to just throw this in the middle. And so what's the right order here, Stephen, the good news or the bad news?
Well, you go with the you lead with the bad news. So
give me the bad news
first.
What's
the bad news?
Well, the bad news is that we, unfortunately, once again, are going to have to postpone the beginning of the World Transform 2. So I apologize to all of our listeners who have been eagerly awaiting it. I can tell you, no more eagerly than Stephen and I have been awaiting getting going with this. We're tremendously eager to have our new series. Unfortunately, my current job situation has put me in a position where I'm just not able to devote the time that it's going to take to do it correctly. We want to do it right. We want to do a good show. We want to do a show that's the equal, a series that's the equal to the one we did a year and a half ago. And in order to do that, we're going to have to put it off just a little bit longer. It's not going to be another year and a half. I don't even think it'll be 6 months. I think we'll get a good time frame around it and have it very soon.
I think they're turning on us in the chat room, man.
No, it's an angry mob. It's a good thing this is the virtual studio. They don't know where we are.
they track us down.
That's the saving grace. But now let me give you the good news. As I was thinking about how we can move ahead with Fast Forward Radio, with the World Transformed on my flight out to Chicago the other night, I had a brainstorm for how we're going to do this next series. One of the things that I've observed, and I think probably some others have who've been listening along with me to the archive shows each week, is that those shows hold up very well. The discussions of those issues and the general philosophical introduction to those topics is something that we don't need to replace. So instead, what I want to do is I want to take some new transformations, some ideas that rely on the same transformations we talked about in the original World Transform, but that have to do with transformations within our own lives, within our own lives individually. And we're going to address those, and we're going to be talking to all the same people that we spoke to in the first series, but how we present that is going to be significantly different, and the interaction between us and them, and just basically how this is delivered is going to be a major we're taking it up a notch, put it that way. We always said we needed to take it up a notch the next time we did The World Transformed, and I hadn't quite figured out how we were going to do that, and now I've got a great bead on exactly how we're going to do that. It's going to be a somewhat snappier, a little bit edgier approach to the same topics. We're going to be talking to more people than we did the first time out. It'll be a superset of our original group, and it's going to be a blast. We're going to have so much fun with this in retrospect, all of these angry yahoos standing outside the studio now with their torches and their rope are going to say, "Oh, we're glad we waited, because this show is truly what we were hoping for from The World Transformed."
Yeah, and it'll be worth the wait. It'll be worth the wait.
It will absolutely be worth the wait. And I see that we've made it all the way to the Geico woodchuck commercial. So quit chucking our radio show. I'm sorry that we have to wait, but it's absolutely going to be worth it. And it's only because we really truly want to do the best possible show that we're putting it off just a little bit longer.
Okay, so in the
and
time
Ken, when I say
left,
angry yahoos, I mean that as a compliment, of course.
That's
we
a mean
term
that's
of endearment
best
here in Denver.
Yeah, that's the
absolutely
best possible. Yeah. Well, anyway, so let's cover these diseases that we have reason to believe that will be better addressed in the next 20 years is with the time frame. So
yeah, this was cool. Our good friend Christian Nisham over at I Look Forward To included me in yet another one of his surveys. It's always great to hear from him. He always asks these wonderful questions. And he wrote to me and said, what are the 10 diseases that we'll cure in the next 20 years? And I told him, man, 10 is a big, long list, okay? That is a bigger list than I would be comfortable trying to answer. Now, David Pierce from abolitionist.com, he was more comfortable naming the whole 10. But what I came up with was most forms of cancer, so you can count that as many as you want, heart disease, arthritis, Alzheimer's, and Parkinson's. And I started answering that from one of the statements that you've heard me make many times, which is that I don't know about curing cancer, although we see cancer being treated, essentially eliminated in different ways for different people, different kinds of cancer. It's happening all the time. This is something that is that tremendous progress is being made with all the time. But I'm on the record as saying that we're within 20 years of cancer being something at worst that people currently live with the way they do diabetes. That the notion of any form of cancer being an automatic death sentence will no longer exist. That we'll view it at worst as how
we mentioned. I'm sorry, Phil, to interrupt. I think we mentioned last week the awesome news about the blood test for cancer. It's just huge. That basically, what's going to happen? The way I envision it is that we'll probably all have cancer in the future from time to, if, when you're living to be, 120 years old, you're just going to, cancer is like, a fact of life. The same, the way a common cold
like
is
like liver
now.
Spots, right? It's like ear
yeah,
hair,
it's just that,
right? It's a thing that'll happen when you
have
it. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's going to happen. And so you just have periodic blood tests every 6 months or so. You go in, you have a blood test, maybe once a year, or maybe every 6 months, whatever. And, we see you've got a little cancer. No big deal. Let's give you the targeted chemo for this particular type of cancer. Will there be any side effects? Not really. You'll hardly notice it. And we'll check you again. Here, take this and come back and see us in 3 weeks. And, and you know, that's the way I foresee it. You know, I is that pretty much what you're seeing as well as?
I think so, and that's and you know, yeah. Again, that's the worst case scenario, because as Sally points out, that once we're controlling genes, switching them on and off, it's entirely possible that we'll be able to cure just about any kind of cancer. But I love Black Hat's question: sexy immortal cancerous billionaires? Question mark. Frowny face. My answer to that, you know what my answer to that is? Hey, as long as they're sexy, right? No, no, actually, that sexy is not the answer. As long as it's something that can be dealt with, and at this point, we're talking about what we call actuarial escape velocity, or very near to it. We're talking about people living significantly longer, and people who make it to the day when we're dealing with cancer the way people currently deal with diabetes will eventually get to that day. If it's not 20 years from now, maybe 50, 60 years from now, when Sally's prediction comes true and all cancer is eliminated.
Well,
I think that's very
likely. I think I should make a slight distinction between what you're talking about, Phil, and what I mean. I think that I'm not saying that, you know, cancer is going to be the sort of thing that is managed over a long period of time. I'm saying we'll all have it from time to time, and we will cure it as soon as we find it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And then
exactly.
You know, and then
now I don't,
you know,
I don't know
that
that'll be the case in 20 years. That's my point. Maybe.
Yeah.
I hope so.
Okay.
But if it's not in 20 years, in 50 years, it definitely will be.
Yeah.
But you'd give that one 20?
Yeah, I would give that 20. I would say in 20, cancer will be no big deal at all. You find out, and one of the reasons it won't be any big deal is that you will find out when it's so small that it can be dealt with very easily. No surgery. The chemo that you'll take at that time will be targeted. It won't affect healthy cells at all. It'll be gobbled up by the cancerous cells, and then it'll kill the cancerous cells, and you'll take another blood test, and good, it's gone. We'll see you for your regular checkup in a year. You know, that's the way I see it going down, and I would put it within 20 years.
Okay, well, and I would count that as the best case. So you know, I'm Mr. Hedge, right? I'll give you a worst case and a best case, because it's really hard to say exactly what's going to happen in 20 years. If I can say 20 to 50, then I'm comfortable saying these are all gone. 50 years from now, these are not diseases that a person suffers with. These are not diseases that a person manages or treats. These are diseases that are cured, and that goes for everything on my list and everything on David's list as well.
Let's just roll through your list real quick. I mean, you basically said most forms of cancer, heart disease, arthritis. There you go, Sally. She's mentioned a couple times in the chat room. She's pulling for that.
Alzheimer's
and Parkinson's. So
Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, which may end up being, as we learn more, like variations of the same of the same thing, and which in fact there's a kind of radical school of thought which is now describing Alzheimer's as type 3 diabetes. Which is really interesting, and we'll come back to that when we talk about one of the additions that you want to make to the list. Now David's list is very similar to mine: most cancers, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, blindness, which I didn't think about, but I couldn't agree more, multiple
right.
sclerosis, alcoholism, depression, anxiety disorders, heart disease, and arthritis. So
Can I mention about blindness real quick? In the TED Talk that we're referencing, we've referenced several times in the show tonight, Enrique, I apologize for forgetting his last name. He mentions...
Juan Enrique,
thank you.
Yeah.
He mentions that, you know, now people, commonly, if you lose your hearing completely, you have a cochlear implant, a cochlear implant.
Yeah.
It's an interesting treatment because it is a one-way deal. You know, if you decide to go with a cochlear implant, it requires a disconnecting of the eardrums completely.
Right.
It involves brain surgery, and you basically are connecting the brain to this processor that's on the outside of your skull there that it takes in, and you are able to hear then, and you're able, you know, and basically I've heard it described as like experiencing the world through a micro cassette recorder, which is not great, but man, it's a world better than not being able to hear at all. And and Mr. Enrique is saying, and within that talk, that, you know, that's what it's like right now. But, you know, it's a world better than it was 20 or 30 years ago when the cochlear implants first came out, where you could just kind of hear, you know, maybe a loud sound, but you couldn't distinguish, you know, speech at all.
Right. Well, I mean, the cochlear implant is the reason that deafness isn't on the list. Even David's list, which was expanded. I mean, deafness has essentially been cured. I mean, we're there. We got
exactly.
The cure can get better, and it can get a lot better. But it's there. I mean, people who could not hear can hear.
Well, he is saying basically when the day will come, according to Mr. Enriquez, where those with cochlear implants will have better hearing than we do, than people with normal ears. You know, it'd be like the bionic woman or whatever. And it may very well be that and blindness is has been a tougher nut to crack. But we're beginning to see, basically late 1970s, early 1980s era cochlear implants. We're about at that level now for vision. For people who are blind, basically tapping into the visual cortex and allowing them to have, you know, see that way. That's about where we are right now. So we got a long way to go with vision, but amazing where that could go. So there you are.
Absolutely. And then to the list, you would add schizophrenia, as we discussed earlier, and then I think you had another item to add to the list.
Yeah. Obesity. Obesity is something that so many of us in the developed world have to deal with, particularly as the years go by. It seems like it's as if the metabolic gears kind of get stripped out, and what didn't make us fat in our 20s, you eat the same thing and you get fat. So,
right.
If we're living longer and longer, does that mean that we're going to end up, you know, having to be removed from our houses at age 150 with a crane? I can't imagine that would be a fun existence. So what are we going to do about that? Well, we got to have some better treatments for obesity. So I would definitely, and imagine a blockbuster development. I mean, in medicine, imagine if you're the company that comes out with something that actually works and gives people the ability to slim down without the horrible having to do without that people have now. So exactly, that's a big deal. And when you take care of obesity, you take care of a lot of other things too. They're on the list even. By taking care of excess weight, you're also dealing with diabetes, heart disease. I don't think you mentioned high blood pressure, but, you know, that's a big
Absolutely.
Deal as well.
High blood pressure, you know what? Obesity is closely linked with numerous forms of cancer, and it is also increasingly linked with Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, and thus the description by some of Alzheimer's as type 3 diabetes. Now, I'm going to tell you that what I've discovered over the past week and a half, having completed the book that I mentioned in passing last week, Why We Get Fat, by, I want to give his name correctly, Gary Tobes, that the cure exists. There is a cure for obesity, and it's been roundly rejected by not science. The scientists agree what the cure is. It's been roundly rejected by our medical establishment and by the public health policy infrastructure, which has kind of informed how the medical community looks at obesity. And I want to read just a little bit from a review on Amazon of this book, because I really think it captures the point to a T. This reviewer says, The most important point of the book is that all those public recommendations, the food pyramid, the, quote, eat food, not too much approach, everything we know about a balanced lifestyle is founded on the premise of calories in versus calories out, that we get fat because we eat too many calories or we don't burn enough of them through movement. But this is nonsense. It's not just wrong. It is actually not a statement about what causes obesity at all, or heart disease, cancer, or diabetes for that matter. It is, in Tobe's words, a junior high-level mistake because it tells us nothing about fat accumulation. If we get fat, by definition, we have taken in more calories than we put out. But why we took in those calories or didn't burn them is the key point. And what Tobe outlines in this book is in great detail something that many of us are familiar with. If you've ever read on the subject of low-carb dieting, then you're familiar with this notion that if you don't eat any carbs or if you drastically cut the number of carbohydrates that you're eating, you cut your blood sugar level, you cut your insulin levels, and your body starts burning fat. The flip side of that, the part that doesn't get talked about as much in those books, although obviously it's there and it's been well understood by medical science for quite some time, is that our bodies produce fat because our insulin levels are raised. It's really much more related to that than it is than it has to do with the number of calories consumed or the number of calories that one attempts to burn off. One of the great examples given in the book, he talks about a study that was done on folks who decided to run marathons in order to lose weight. Right? If it's calories in, calories out. Let's take the exercise part. We'll take the calories out side of it. And people who had been basically sedentary, most of their adult lives, they go on not a very strict diet, but a controlled diet, and they start exercising regularly, and they start training for a marathon, start running a marathon. So it's this very intensive, couple hours of training a day. And at the end of a year, the women had lost no weight. I mean, they're in great shape, right? They were the cardiovascular system is good. The guys, on average, had lost 5 pounds. And yeah. The math just doesn't work. Our bodies grow fat the way tumors grow, not because we're gluttonous or slothful or so many of those other notions that have been laid out. So I highly recommend this book. I always like books that kind of go against the grain. I like thinking that kind of goes against the grain. But when you read this, it suddenly becomes so clear that there is a cure. People just have to stop eating carbohydrates. Or cut them to the point that the fat goes away, and it's just a notion that our medical establishment won't get on board with, and that our public health policy establishment won't get on board with, or at least have not yet. I think
What's the title of that book again, Phil?
Once again, it's called Why We Get Fat.
Okay.
I'll put a link up there, and I think we've got the cure to obesity. We just have to start curing it. All right, I know we're close on the time. Stephen, what's our music?
Our music tonight is Go, 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 Tokyo by the Rubinos.
All right, the Rubinos singing Go, 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 Tokyo. Thanks for putting that together, Stephen. It's always a pleasure talking with you, everyone in the chat room, everyone listening live or listening via MP3. Thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back on with an archived World Transformed on Saturday, another dip into the archives on Monday, and back on live a week from tonight. Look forward to talking with you on each of those programs, and until next time, live to see it.
They got the GS sound that I wanted to hear. Electrifying to my ears. They got the fuzziest fuzz and the whitest wall. I get that to Tokyo. Indoor surf, karaoke bar. Bullet trains and a baseball stop. I wanna go, go, go back to Tokyo.
Go, go, go
back to Tokyo. Make a big splash. It's such a rush, such a rush, such a rush, it's such a rush.